Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today we have a very special program as we'll be discussing a different kind of book than usual, one that has chapters authored by 50 different contributors and spans an intimidating 1,100 pages over two volumes. The book is titled A Companion to U.S. Foreign Relations, Colonial Era to the Present, and it was published last year by Wiley Blackwell. The production of The Companion over the last few years, involving such a large number of contributors, constituted a discipline-wide debate about what the history of U.S. foreign relations has been, what it is currently, and where it's going. And so I think it's a really useful candidate for a podcast like ours, because we'll have a chance to talk about all of these things. Our guides through this gargantuan book will be Christopher Dietrich, a historian at Fordham University. His work looks at decolonization, resource extraction, and the U.S. relations with the Global South, and he is the editor of The Companion. As well, we have two historians who contributed chapters on either end of the book's chronology. We'll be speaking with Emily Conroy Krutz, a historian at Michigan State University, who researches the history of religion, foreign missionaries, and women in the early republic. And finally, Megan Black, a historian at MIT, whose research looks at 20th century environmental history and relations between the state and capital. And so this has been a long introduction, so let's just get right into it. Thank you all for being on the program today.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Dexter.
And just to begin, I'd love to hear how the three of you got sucked into studying the history of U.S. foreign relations. And so, Emily, do you want to maybe start just sharing your experiences?
Sure. I got into foreign relations history by accident, actually, coming into it from religious history and women's history. Had been working on, was going to be working on women and religion, and early in grad school was starting to dig around into a possible seminar paper on marriage and missionaries. And when I got into some of the sources, was really surprised to see what actually happened when these first missionaries went to India in 1812, and the War of 1812 began on their way. So they sort of left during time of peace and arrived in British territory when the U.S. was at war with England, and was so intrigued by why this had happened and what they thought they were doing, and how they handled that situation in the years coming, and just sort of fell into being really interested first in Anglo-American relations and then sort of U.S. and the world more generally in the early republic in the 19th century. So it seemed weird to me that those kinds of stories had not been part of the U.S. history I had been taught before in college. So that's sort of where, how I ended up here, very accidentally.
Mm-hmm. And Megan, how about yourself?
Well, I trained in an American studies program at George Washington University. So I was straddling fields, and I really empathize with what Emily just said about the kind of happy accidents of sources taking you down a bit of a rabbit hole. I had an interest in something like minerals and an intersection of domestic and foreign relations, but from more of a cultural perspective and had found some of these films that were sponsored by the U.S. Department of the Interior and were telling very global narratives about the pursuit of natural resources. The point at which I went to National Archives to then see the kind of textual document story behind these films was one that sort of fed into a more overtly project in U.S. foreign relations, because I saw that these films were circulating overseas in the post-war era in the context of international development. And so the question shifted from, you know, what is being told in these films to how are these films going to Afghanistan? And that then in turn became a story about the U.S. Interior Department and its pushing beyond the threshold of existing borders and sovereignty in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, yourself?
Yeah, sure. I certainly also entered the field, you know, sort of by what Alexander Hamilton might have called dumb luck. I had a friend from high school who was in graduate school in the time that I was in Peace Corps. He sent me his master's thesis by mail, and I read it. I thought it was fascinating, and I thought I could you know, I might be able to do this. And then I applied to graduate schools, and I was accepted at the University of Texas to work with Mark Lawrence, who then had just finished his book on the Vietnam Wars. And I thought I was going to do U.S. Latin American relations and focus on U.S.-Mexico relations in the late 70s and early 80s. But there wasn't as much of a documentary record for that declassified in the U.S. archives. And I sort of gravitated in a similar way to the way that Megan did by asking questions about that topic that led me down the road to ask other questions about the nature of debt, where it came from, and to begin to look at the 1970s. So, you know, I went down a few different rabbit holes in the research process, and then I came out thinking about sort of international elites and anti-colonialism in oil.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So primary sources were sort of the gateway drug for for all of your projects and your interest in U.S. foreign relations history. And Chris, I want to ask you about your approach. So in your introduction, you talk about the many histories of U.S. foreign relations rather than a singular story. And the contributions in the two volumes really reflect this. You know, more traditional topics are, you know, sitting alongside, you know, more recent topics, or at least like more recently included in U.S. foreign relations topics. And I think this embrace of pluralism, it really marks the current field. And I think to understand this, I think we should really go back in time and think about what the field used to look like. And so, I mean, Chris or Megan or Emily, can one of you give us a snapshot of what the history of U.S. foreign relations might have looked like in, say, the 80s or 90s?
I can take a first crack at that, and I'd be really happy to hear what Megan and Emily think. One of the things that I was really excited about when I read the first drafts of the different chapters was to see just how far back different scholars were going when they were talking about their field and the historiography in their specific fields. And you get the idea that you know, it really is a collective enterprise, not only now, but over time. It has been a collective enterprise of building knowledge. So I've you know, felt like sometimes the distinction between then and now, between new approaches and more traditional ones, is actually more dynamic and fluid than we usually talk about it, because I think if you look back at you know, the historiography, say in the late 80s and early 90s, when we have these big turns that people emphasize, there really were histories then that look a lot like the new approaches now, and that those new approaches approaches build on. And so I think that you know, some of the international turn and transnational turn especially, but also the cultural turn was evident before we noted, and has actually been part of the history of U.S. foreign relations for quite some time. So that's one part of it. Another aspect, I suppose, when we think about how we tend to discuss these things, is sort of a movement away from traditional state-based emphases on questions of power. And I also, I think that a big tent collective understanding really is the consensus now. And I don't see, you know, this is a problem of moving away from a certain way of doing history. I would say that it actually, you know, builds on it and adds to it in important ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. The only thing I would add is that I think where we do see change is that some of those other approaches in sort of gender history and cultural history that were doing the kind of work that we now recognize as foreign relations history maybe wouldn't have identified themselves that way earlier. And so what's been really interesting is sort of that the tent seems bigger and more people are choosing to identify within sort of under that umbrella of foreign relations history, which makes it a really exciting field and a really exciting time to be doing this work.
Great. I think those comments are so smart. And I'll just add to this kind of theme of bridge building between fields by noting that, you know, there was some early interest, and especially when I think of the kind of mineral history as one umbrella to think through different investments across subfields. I see that folks like David Painter and others were thinking about capitalism and history of capitalism from a particular vantage point that in turn is you know, elaborated by a different generation in the same way that the kind of Emily Rosenberg introduction of economic and cultural ideas to the kind of state power big tent that Chris described is something that has been elaborated and helped to, yes, create a space in which people working at different intersections then feel a kind of a shared enterprise. And we've learned a lot from it, which is really exciting.
Mm-hmm. I agree that all these comments are super smart, and they're making me think in so many different directions. One of the things across each of your comments was that, you know, there was work that preceded these, you know, international turns, transnational turns, but then like that work was then reincorporated into, it started to self-identify as U.S. foreign relations history. Well, I'm just thinking about like what were the factors that pushed the field to broaden and diversify in this way?
I think that you had historians. I mean, I don't think any of us can really speak with any great expertise on this because we were we were young and not probably not even in college, and maybe not even in middle school or high school yet when these changes happened. But it seems to me like there was sort of an expanding toolkit that was being offered to historians, especially with the cultural turn that allowed historians to receive a wider range of training in the sorts of questions that they could ask and in the sorts of archives that they would look at. So not only what archives they look at, but the kind of questions they would ask of those archives. So I think that there was a great deal of training that encouraged sort of multiple perspectives and even interdisciplinary work in the 80s and 90s. I also think that when it comes to the international turn, I believe that globalization in the 70s and after had a huge effect on the ability of people to do sort of multi-local research, to travel, to immerse themselves in other cultures, to learn the languages, and to really try to understand, usually bilateral relations fully from each side. So you have, I'm a U.S. and then name this country, name this region, historian. And a lot of people identified as that type of historian. It seems to me like in the 70s and 80s, 90s, and expanded beyond Europe. Because when I think about international history, and I say that, you know, that it existed before it was really named, I'm usually thinking of historians, you know, like Akira Rie or Mark Trachtenberg, who were really looking at stories that had two parts, and they were fully immersed in each of those parts.
Okay, so just to move on to Emily's chapter, I think it'd be useful to kind of like dig into some particular chapters, and you know, Emily's appears first in the chronology, and so Emily, in your chapter, which is called The Early Republic in a World of Empire, 1787 to 1848, you make the case for stretching conversations about the U.S. and empire way farther back than is traditionally done so. And so, like, you know, the very traditional starting point is 1898, or maybe at some point in the 1890s. But you make the case that, like, we should be thinking about empire basically from the founding of the United States. Can you walk our listeners through this?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, as you said, that the traditional chronology would be 1898, which is the beginning of U.S. overseas empire. And what 19th century historians, historians of the founding era, have been doing work for a long time now on thinking about these moments earlier in American history that actually are imperial moments. And this is particularly true if we think about Native American history and indigenous history and U.S. relations with Native nations, our foreign relations. And that is a story of empire. It's a story of settler colonialism. And so what I do in the chapter here is I talk about the different language we use to talk about empire. How was it that people in the founding generations were using that word, because they did, to describe the United States? What did they mean when they called America an empire? And then how does that language sort of continue over the course of the century? So I talk here about sort of settler colonialism and what we have long talked about in, again, that sort of traditional language that Americans use when they talk about their history as expansion and expansionism, that's also an imperial story. And we can talk about that as settler colonialism. The colonization movement of freed African Americans to Liberia, that's a story of early American imperialism. That's the 1820s, 1830s. The missionary movement that I work on in my own research is a really useful window for thinking about how Americans were thinking about empire all over the place. Because a lot of the logic that was behind these missionaries was that empires were a form of connecting different states and different peoples, and could and should work for the good if they were sort of centered in Christian governments, which these early Americans understood the United States to be, as they understood the British to be. And so as they went out around the world, they were expecting to benefit from imperial structures, largely with the British, but also with some American imperial organizations, and were in practice really kind of working out, how does empire look like on the ground? Is this working out the way that it should be? Is this actually how the U.S. should be relating to the world? And so I think that sort of in my broader work, and also in this chapter, what I've really found interesting with this group of folks is that we see that empire was not a code for, you know, a bad and oppressive form of government in this period. Empire was the norm for world governments. And so it shouldn't surprise us that Americans who are coming out of being part of an imperial system are sort of thinking about themselves as potentially a new empire. They wanted it to be a little bit different than how the British did it. But that's because they, I mean, and so what some of this sort of American Revolution and early Republican historiography talks about is that the revolution is, it's a war about empire, but not not necessarily against empire. It's against the British Empire. It's about against the relationship that the that these 13 colonies had with that particular metropole. But that doesn't mean that when you get out of the, on the other side of the war, that everyone in the U.S. opposes empire as a governmental form. They want it in a slightly different, you know, a slightly different framework. But a lot of that language makes sense.
Sorry, Emily, for cutting you off.
No, please do.
I would actually love for you to really briefly talk about this like key example in your work, because it's really interesting. It's the example of these missionaries who tried to get the U.S. to build a colony in Singapore.
Yes.
I think that just like unlocks a lot of the stuff that you're talking about.
The Singapore story is great. So this was in the late 1830s, when a group of missionaries from the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions were they were in Singapore, and their work as missionaries, they were there working on their language skills, translating texts, distributing tracts and Bibles and things like that, and they wrote to the United States after having met with the American consul and spoken to people on the ground about how they need to set up, really should consider setting up a colonization society for an American colony in Singapore. And this doesn't happen. This is a story of failure. But I think sometimes these stories of things that don't work out can actually be really useful windows into what people thought could happen, actually. And so what they had wanted to do, what they meant by a colony, is actually a lot like they wanted this colonial society to be modeled on the American Colonization Society for Liberia. So it would be bringing sort of a group of American colonists who the missionaries said that they understood that there were a lot of pious Americans who were hardworking, who were not clergy, who were interested in this part of the world, interested in helping this part of the world, but wouldn't be doing so as missionaries. They would be doing so as there'd be a they wanted a watchmaker, they wanted farmers, they wanted mechanics and people like this who could come and set up a an American colony that would model for local people sort of what civilized life would look like. And the consul thought this was a great idea. They had started talking about what, you know, how would they be able to purchase the property for this? What would that look like? What would be the legal implications of this? And it gets quashed largely because of concerns in Boston, not concerns that this is, you know, just a ridiculous idea, but rather concerns that this is, it's not practical because of Anglo-American relations. And so the worry that, in Boston, that's where the Missionary Society was based. The folks back there were worried that the British would react negatively to sort of Americans coming in and trying to set up their own colony in these places. And they worried that it would have bad effects on so the global work that they were doing elsewhere around the world. But in theory, they liked this idea. And this was what they had been doing elsewhere. It was what it certainly was going on in Liberia. In sort of the practical terms of what they were describing is a lot like what they what was going on with Americans in Hawaii, very much like what American missionaries were doing in with some Native American nations, sort of setting up these setting up schools that were really about industrial education and things like this, and bringing about a transformation in the culture, in the economy, and often, you know, they hoped eventually the government too, as well as gender relations and social relations and things like this. And I think that is a story that we're not used to thinking about sort of Americans in the 1830s, you know, imagining their place in the world in that way. But there's lots of stories like that. And there's lots of Americans around the world who are, you know, maybe not trying to set up colonies everywhere, but there are filibusterers who are, you know, doing kind of similar sorts of imagination about the U.S. relations with Latin America in these years. And once we, I think, come to terms with those stories, the chronology that we've been working with for a long time of American empire just falls apart. And we really have to come to terms with the fact that this is a country that has been, you know, experimenting with and thinking about and practicing different forms of empire throughout its entire history.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this periodization that you're talking about so much more, so it's just so powerful, because it does force us to rethink like U.S. history even more broadly. And I would love to, I mean, there's so much in your chapter that we could talk about, but in the interest of time, I just want to jump ahead to Megan's chapter, which again, I really enjoyed. It's titled Mineral Frontiers in the 20th Century. And Megan, I want to start with how you start your chapter, which is an anecdote about how the U.S. was imagining setting up a mine on the moon. And I know this is something that you've written about in elsewhere, in addition to this mm-hmm. chapter. Mm-hmm. And I would just love to hear that story, and then also like what it says about this moment in U.S. history, minerals, and U.S. foreign policy.
Great. Well, like you, I was struck by this anecdote of a sort of press release on July 4th, 1965, where the U.S. government is celebrating its efforts to research mining the moon, which posed many logistical challenges and was not in many ways within reach because of the technological and economic situation of the moment. But to me, it brings together two interesting pillars of the legacies of American empire, which are minerals and frontiers. And they're very much describing this effort as an extension of the United States' efforts to harness new mineral frontiers, this time in lunar landscapes. But the moment in the 1960s is one that helps really pick up on the narrative that Emily sort of gave us about the lead up to the 19th century, in that they're very much grappling with legacies of empire. And one thing that I've found about focusing on minerals as a kind of physical thing, as a spatial thing that is tied to ideas of frontiers as well, is that they get at the problem of borders very effectively, especially when we think about a century where there are increased global commitments to respecting borders. So much of what the kind of historiography that I try to track with is grappling with is a set of transitions over the 20th century from conditions of formal empire continuing to present a set of problems for the United States. It had already undertaken different forms of empire in a continental sense, in an island and overseas sense in the Pacific and Caribbean. But it was also operating increasingly in a context where international order was constantly debated, where the nation itself transitioned to other informal means of continuing to exert a kind of influence or exploitation of landscapes beyond borders, which minerals help us to get at the heart of, in other forms, like a more like global hegemony frame. But thinking about minerals reminds us that there have been situations in which a kind of raw material exploitation that we associate with things like the bad forms of empire that the United States would like to eschew, right? Like the British imperialism that it escaped, you know, in its anti-colonial struggle, the other bad forms of imperialism that had been exposed through kinds of humanitarian exposés like that of King Leopold in Belgian Congo, or other figures, Cecil Rhodes in Southern Africa. So the problem is that the continued pursuit of minerals helped to unravel this exceptionalist narrative in many ways, as we track with a different array of actors operating across borders. Sometimes it is representatives of the US state, sometimes it is corporate interests that are being supported by or constrained by the US state in zones around the world, including the global south. And when we think with the environment, you know, moving from the background of the story to the foreground, we can see that massive transformations of landscapes unfolded in a kind of post-war period, at a point at which, through the founding of the United Nations, many, including the United States, signaled this commitment to borders and self-determination. Yet when looking at the ground, one sees that many of the asymmetries and dynamics associated with imperialism continued in new forms. So the kinds of problems that Chris's work and others get at around decolonization presents incentives to think about new zones. And this is sort of one way that I end up in that chapter, and how I end up in outer space, right, is to think of seemingly unpopulated expanses or alternatives closer to home that seem within reach, that present a kind of material set of possibilities, but that are not going to trigger the same anti-imperialist alarms that had long been raised, because of course there had been resistance across borders and internally to the United States against a kind of project that continued the expansive unfolding that, as Emily pointed out, begins with settler colonialism and has different names attached to it over time. But here we see then that the oceans, the continental shelf, and aspects of outer space become appealing as venues for these continued pursuits that aren't inevitable and aren't even necessarily rational or logical in some sense, but that that have kind of continued relevance in a 20th century context.
Yeah, and I just wanted to pick up on both of these comments and say that in these essays and many of the other essays, we really do see the benefit of cross-pollination between newer turns and more traditional ways, state-centered ways of doing diplomatic history. You know, in Emily's chapter, she mentions briefly Worcester versus Georgia from 1832. I've just been reading Claudio Sant's new book on Indian removal, and you know, that's one example where you have sort of a very strong, what I guess we could describe as policy history or political history or diplomatic history, alongside a transnational emphasis, an emphasis on ideology that really strengthens those histories. She also mentions Jennifer Thigpen and her work on Hawaiian political leaders, which definitely enriches our understanding of the success or failure of different American policies in that time. In Megan's work, there are, you know, a number of examples of this as well. Whether it has to do with strategic minerals, or you know, when she notes the effect of the location of strategic minerals in certain countries, shaping how American leaders deal with those countries' governments and really accepting, anti-democratic governments in those countries as necessary for that stability. And that speaks to something that happened more broadly in these volumes that I wasn't expecting when I asked different authors to do that, but that was this emphasis that Megan's noted on American empire, on imperialism as a framework. There are a lot of chapters that discuss empire really explicitly, whether it's April Merlot's chapter on U.S. drug policy, Andrew Friedman's chapter on ideology, Mark Palin on political economy and war and peace, or Sarah Steinbach-Pratt's chapter, which looks at the historiography really closely of American empire and many others. So it seems to me like this sort of imperial framework is a really interesting one that's getting a lot of attention from scholars.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up all those other chapters. Andrew Friedman's in particular has this amazing line that I think, really shows, how present the imperial framework is in these volumes. He writes, in reference to all these, scholars of, history of capitalism, labor, geography, American studies, he says they don't just ask the classic question, does the U.S. have or not have an empire? They say, look at all this. What would you call it? And I think that, that these older like definitional disputes are kind of like cast aside. There's this acceptance, there's a consensus that the U.S. is an empire. Like, what kind of empire is it? I wasn't thinking about this when I originally asked Emily and Megan to come onto the podcast, but both of their chapters also like stretch the imperial framework, geographically, but then also temporally in interesting ways. I don't know if Megan or Emily, you'd like to chime in on the imperial.
I'm jealous of Friedman's line. That was really good. and I think it gets to, some of the stuff that, Paul Kramer talks about in his article on imperialism versus empire, right? We have spent a lot of time as American historians really arguing over, was it or wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And that's not the most productive or interesting question. It really is, what kind of empire? What do we mean when we're talking about imperialism? And let's look at the power dynamics and let's look at, hierarchies of race within this. And if we, can, I think, get away from, I think really is sort of a legacy of exceptionalist approaches to American history that, the U.S. wasn't an empire. All these other places were an empire until, much later in its history. And if we can kind of get past that and, look at this stuff and say, okay, well, what words would we use? How should we describe this? Then that lets us get at the much more interesting questions in the history.
I would just add, these comments are making me think about something Chris had said earlier about the expanded toolkit and the cultural turn as well, and how influential something like Cultures of U.S. Imperialism by Amy Kaplan and Donald Pease was for me in my work, and I think in many scholars' work in the kind of foreign relations world, as something that helps us to get at a different set of questions as well about the logic of empire and about the different rationales by which the United States could maintain a very important narrative of its global power, which is that it was fundamentally natural and good. So in many different ways that the attention to differentiation within the nation, to questions of race and gender in U.S. history is one that has allowed scholars to see intersections then between domestic and foreign, and to ask about the things that must be invisible for certain wisdoms to hold true, especially vis-a-vis benevolent power.
Yeah, Chris, do you want to say anything else on this before we move on?
I could just add that I think that a lot of what we're talking about here has to do with national identity, mm-hmm. And how the United States and different actors in the United States perceive their place in the world. I was just nodding my head as Megan and Emily were speaking. There are a lot of really great essays in this volume that think about these questions explicitly, but also tied to specific moments in U.S. history, which is why I wanted to organize it chronologically and let the authors use their expertise to draw what they thought the most important themes were. Emily has a great line at the end of hers about the Mexican War. And she says, when Americans argued about the Mexican War, they're arguing about national identity and their country's role in the world. And then she lays out sort of the opponents' arguments and supporters of the war's arguments, and then discusses filibusterism and manifest destiny, and makes the point that this question of identity and different identities as they relate to foreign relations need to be studied from all different perspectives, political, cultural, race, gender, et cetera. So I think here, for me, national identity has been a really useful way to think about the exercise of power.
Mm-hmm. And sort of continuing on this theme of the imperial, one of the really exciting and critical and necessary changes to the field in recent years is the increasingly common move to frame relations between Native American nations and the United States as a form of foreign relations. And so, I'm thinking about, work like Brian DeLay's book, on the U.S.-Mexican War. But then also Elspeth Martini's chapter in the first volume is really good on this. I feel myself kind of teeing up this question, but I think it's important to talk about anyway. But why do you think it took so long for historians of foreign relations, historians of U.S. foreign relations, to make this move?
Well, that's a good question.
Yes.
It's too bad Elspeth isn't here because she's so brilliant on this. I actually am working on another edited volume and I'm co-editing with Michael Blakeman and Nolani Arista on early American empire. And one of the things that we are trying to do in that volume is bring together a bunch of different groups of scholars who have been sort of siloed in their conversations about these exact topics that we're talking about right now around empire and early America. And, we're finding that a ton of our chapters in that volume are on Native American history and settler colonialism. And it's, I wonder if, this work isn't new. It's not like, the people who've been working on Native American history have not for a long time been talking about America as an empire. I think this is part of what I meant when I was saying earlier about sort of the, more people are choosing to identify with foreign relations, that the sense that sort of that existing work is now able to be a part of the conversation is sort of being brought to the table and sort of happening in different contexts is the change that we're seeing. And why it took foreign relations scholars to take so long to wake up to the fact that Native American nations were foreign nations and relations with them were foreign relations. I wish I knew, but it is, I think it's really for the good that now we are sort of seeing more of an incorporation of, that existing and ongoing scholarship into our understanding of American foreign relations.
I really like your comments there, Emily. It's a great framing and exciting to see this kind of intersection become more highly trafficked. Thinking about that question, I am really conjuring or calling to mind Brian DeLay's essay in Diplomatic History that puts forward the idea of polities as a way to get out of a problem of the way historical actors coming from a kind of Western Enlightenment frame perceived indigenous sovereignty as something like a lesser order of something that didn't conform to political understandings of a kind of modern governance structure. And there are reasons that indigenous nations wouldn't want to accept the kind of imposition of those categories either. Whereas polities is something that allows us to think through the consonances or, you know, the continuities between and across these ways of organizing society and marshaling resources and directing action. So, you know, I think on some level, there has been a way in which historians have followed the assumptions of historical actors who, you know, shared in that kind of downgrading set of assumptions. But from a kind of historiographical perspective, the kind of insistence that the United States was not imperial is one that participated in that erasure, right? Because, you know, it must sustain the myth that the United States was not an empire from the settler colonial contact and moment of dispossession that became more and more systematic over time. And the downgrading, I think, is really apparent to me in like the 20th century frame where, you know, there's such a kind of assumption of its being effectively disbanded or subordinated in and through the kind of assimilationist policies that that set up the conditions of the 20th century, even as Native nations continue to assert a right to sovereign distinction and cultural separation. But yeah, I think that was a fascinating line, Dexter, to kind of draw between Emily and I as I then think about some Native nations trying to deal with the problem of 20th century actors arriving at reservation boundaries and seeking different kinds of arrangements, like the leasing of minerals to facilitate different kinds of national interests, whether in energy or other commodities. And that is something that does seem to recapitulate longstanding dispossessive drives, even as it also takes new forms in the 20th century moment, when borders are meant to be respected, when indigenous self-determination is formally recognized, not just in a kind of national policy frame, but also at the level of the United Nations.
Yeah, I would just very quickly add to that, that Elspeth in her chapter, calls for sort of new works in U.S. Native American diplomacies that are policy focused, legal. Look at borderlands as a potential question, and bring in post-colonial and ethno-historical methods, all of which, in some ways, address this question of sovereignty as being more fungible than it is on paper. I think Megan's work does that really well in her book when she talks about the 1930s, and then again when she moves into the 1970s and questions of extraction on Navajo land. So I do think this is really, really fruitful, and it points to some interesting continuities that that can be explored. I wonder, in the sort of post World War II era, where you have a number of people who are trained in the U.S. government to work as educators on reservations, what do they do when that bureaucratic system begins to close down a little bit? From what I understand, many of them might have moved into the Foreign Service to work for USAID or for the State Department. And so I think that when we ask these kinds of questions, we open up new avenues that might be fruitful, they might not be, but they force us to ask really, really interesting questions.
Yeah, that's a really intriguing example, and I think it shows that historical actors they might materially be experiencing relations between the United States and Native American nations as foreign relations, but they might actually not see that as such. So something that I would like to bring up is Daniel Bessner and Fred Logival's recent article, which I think is, it kickstarted one of the biggest or most vociferous historiographical debates in, at least in the last year. Just for our listeners, it's called Recentering the United States in the Historiography of American Foreign Relations. And essentially what they're doing, at least the way I read it, is they're making two historical claims and then a related historiographical one. For them, firstly, the U.S. has been the most powerful polity in the world since 1945. And this meant that Americans were the ones who had the most influence over U.S. foreign policy. And I think at one point they even referred to the United States as, the sun to the international order solar system. And then number two, American elites often did things for domestic reasons and/or didn't know all that much about the rest of the world. And then finally, their historiographical point is that, because of the international and transnational turns in historiography, historians have overemphasized the influence of non-American historical actors. And so they're making a call for historians to put the U.S. back at the center, to study things like the Pentagon, the presidency, the executive branch more broadly. One reading of this article is a critique of the big tent approach to U.S. foreign relations that, Chris, you talked about in some of your opening remarks. And so I'm just curious how the three of you read this article and, what your general thoughts are. Chris, maybe do you want to start us off?
Sure. I'm happy to go first. I think this is a response to the establishment of a more plural field in the 1990s and after, more than that, a response to the fact that pluralism has become something of a consensus in the field. They do argue in that piece, and I've heard Fred make arguments about this. I think the first time I heard this was when he co-authored with Campbell Craig America's Cold War, and I heard him present on it at a Schaefer, I'm trying to think, when was my son born? 2010 or 2011. And he used the phrase sort of the international steamroller or something along those lines. So this has been a debate that's been that's been happening for some time. And I think they try to make sort of the sharpest, most compelling version of that side of the debate, that the international and transnational and cultural turns potentially lead the field down an anti-statist path. And here I'll quote them directly, that de-emphasizes unduly subjects that traditionally stood at the center of the historiography of U.S. foreign relations, policymaking, and its relationship to the projection of power. And I think the article is useful in terms of that it recounts an important story of the pluralist consensus and sort of the institutional growth of Schaefer, I guess we could say, in the 1990s and after. I think they point out some of the excellent work in international and transnational history. They note why it's so appealing. In many ways, what we've been saying for much of this conversation, and then they turn to a case study of the Vietnam War, in which they also say that new studies of North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese politics and society have enriched the field, but they still believe that something is lost in those turns before they save what they think are good future directions for state-centric and to use the same metaphor, a heliocentric approach. and I agree that that these directions are important, right? The rise that they identify, the rise of U.S. hyperpower, the creation of bipartisan consensus in the second half of the 20th century around American power, the evolution of the national security state, the impact of domestic politics, and then sort of an elite-centered military military history. I think all of that's great. And in fact, some of my own work that I'm doing now falls within those categories. And I agree broadly that we do want to understand political, cultural, economic, ideological identity factors that lead the United States to take the position that it has since World War II, that is sort of waging constant war. I don't necessarily share the same concern that the diffusion of agency in the field is that problematic. I think that on the contrary, editing this volume and the process of working with different authors on their topics led me to feel that even more strongly. I would also say, just as a side note, that I think a lot of this concern comes from the state of jobs in the labor market for historians. I think that that 2015, I can't remember if it was 2015 or 2016, but the jobs report and the number of historians that are identifying as doing diplomatic or international history, and that lower number, I think, was concerning to a lot of people in the field, and I think adds some momentum to this to their viewpoint.
Emily, do you want to?
Yeah, I think what Chris said, I agree totally. One thing I would add that I found, I'm a 19th centuryist, right? So if I'm reading an article, and I really like Danny and Fred a lot, and actually my current book project is sort of in line with a question Fred asked me several years ago at a conference about policy implications of missionaries. So I take a lot of their points. I think it's really interesting, but I find it, you could, titles are their own thing, but their focus here is on post-1945 U.S. foreign relations. And it's suggesting that it is actually about the entirety of the history of U.S. foreign relations. And that's something, I think that's actually a broader thing that the volume Chris edited is a really helpful correction to. Because if we look at more of American history happened before 1945 than happened after 1945, that'll be different at some point in the future. But for right now, pre-1945 history is there. And the, I think, emphasis within the American foreign relations on post-45 as those are the questions and those are the issues that matter, I find just perplexing and not really productive. So it's one of the things I was saying to Chris earlier. It's, as an early American historian, it's wonderful looking at the amount of sort of diversity of chronology that he was able to bring into this volume and how many scholars are, working on a lot of these questions in earlier periods. And, I think a lot of what Danny and Fred are concerned about here, their example of the Vietnam War here is really interesting. I think the point they make about, was it the sort of the hierarchy of causalities is an interesting thing that we should think about. But I guess I don't share a lot of their concerns about the field as a whole. I don't know the jobs report that Chris talked about. I think that is a really big part of this, but I'm not sure how much those descriptors really mean. My job title doesn't include anything about diplomatic history, but I'm doing it. And I think that's true for a lot of us. And so I'm not sure if the crisis that they're trying to respond to here is actually a crisis.
Megan, what about you?
Yeah, so I shared the kind of really positive feelings toward Danny and Fred and have learned so much from their work and from conversations with them. I think about exceptionalism as something that is a powerful force in U.S. history. And I think Fred and I really see eye to eye on a lot of those dynamics and, his points about and their points about thinking about domestic policymaking and things going on among policymakers as a response to electoral politics is incredibly compelling. And so within that, I'm aware that I'm sort of an American studies scholar who operates with that kind of domestic and foreign frame, even as I've learned so much from scholars who have more actively decentered the American state, as they themselves note as well. And I think the one point that I was curious to know more about, or to be able to like sit down and have this conversation as a group, was that point about causal hierarchies that Emily just brought up as well. Because I was thinking as I read it about the kind of causal hierarchies, assuming that certain kinds of events are those that define, you know, a very clear set of foreign relations. In other words, I was thinking about events of global significance that might fall outside of this frame. And if we are thinking about actors that are shaping the fate, say, of the environment, a global environment that itself has many implications for national security and for, you know, global inequality and relations between nations, but also the lives of people who circulate around the globe, or in this moment of incredible immobilization who are unable to do so because of a globe-spanning pathogen. I just wonder if the sort of frame and the assumption of hierarchy might miss certain important events that fall out of the kind of calculus of some leaders and even members of U.S. Congress. So I guess I've seen a lot of actors shaping material environments in ways that are actively a part of the story of climate change. And so I wonder if we kind of take this advice to its logical conclusion about how we think about the important processes that sort of defy the containers that we have for understanding the most important events in diplomatic history, which tend to center around war or trade relations. But there are these other parts of the story about connectors of capitalism and neoliberalism, of international development, and the like, that that I am thinking about a lot, just as part of my intersection between diplomatic and environmental history. So this would make for a really great conversation, but also I think it helps to speak to the kinds of things that I've gained by engaging with that pretty polyvocal and interdisciplinary big tent group of thinkers in foreign relations as well.
I agree with what Megan and Emily have been saying. And I believe that when we're thinking about multi-causality and causal hierarchies, we do need to be very attentive to what shapes the hierarchy that they're looking at, right? And they have a very interesting graphic that sort of elucidates their causal hierarchy. And I would, you know, I would say that if you read closely E.H. Carr, he has sort of a subtle emphasis on context that I believe, you know, throws a wrench in arguments about the universal applicability of any causal hierarchy to any specific moment. Here, you know, I think that Megan made a really good point with environmental history. I keep thinking about Beth Lou Williams' arguments about a multi-scalar approach to immigration history in the Chinese Must Go. I think that a lot of sort of urban histories that move into the transnational realm make a similar sort of point that the origins of policy often aren't where we would think of if we're thinking about a traditional, you know, a quote unquote traditional set of causal hierarchies. My colleague at Fordham, Samantha Iyer, has presented on really interesting type of causality where you have almost, I guess, food riots in Egypt and demands being made on the Egyptian state by sort of very radical groups in turn forcing the Egyptian state to request grain aid from the United States, if I'm remembering that story correctly. So I think that that sort of origin is something that's caught when you have the bigger tent that might be missed when you have a narrower perspective of it. All that said, yeah. I do agree that when we're talking about the field of U.S. relations, questions of power and diplomacy are very much at the core in a lot of the work that I saw in this this volume, if not most of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what's so interesting to think about sort of these, I guess the causality question is to like how the state changes over time. And, you know, so in my research right now on sort of missionary relations with the State Department over the course of the 19th century, I've been thinking a lot about this question of how, you know, who is driving what's happening? And is it, you know, people in the field, these are these missionaries that are far away, is it diplomats? And the answer is, you know, up until pretty late in my story, it's never the state. The state's reacting to stuff that's happening on the ground. And, you know, that makes total sense for how the state is structured in the 19th century. And that's really part of the story I'm telling. And I'm not a 20th centuryist, so you guys can jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. But the sort of sense here that the state is one thing, and these institutions are, strong in this particular kind of way, and Americans in general aren't noticing this stuff that's going on overseas, and you know, domestic politics are sort of driving their thinking more than events overseas. I'm like, I wonder if that's assuming a lot about how these structures actually work and who is, so I think it's precisely what this bigger tent approach gives us is ways of thinking about, who's, you know, where are these unexpected voices that are actually having influence on these other kinds of decisions. And I don't think any one, I don't know the historiography of the Vietnam War that well. So, that example that they used is obviously out of my wheelhouse. But in my reading, the folks who are doing these broader kinds of approaches and not centering the state, I don't see anybody, attributing undue causal power to non-state actors and sort of being irresponsible about that.
Mm-hmm. I think we should wrap it up, but I just wanted to say that I agree with a lot of what they're saying. I mean, like, my dissertation is basically how the United States becomes even more central because of the presence of the United Nations headquarters in New York. So I share a lot of their assumptions, but there's also a pretty good case for studying people who don't have causal power, causal influence. I don't think we should be excluding, a pretty wide range of different kinds of research projects, because the subjects didn't actually have that kind of power. But anyways, this conversation could go on for another hour, but unfortunately, we do have to wrap it up. And so I just want to thank all of you for taking the time to talk to me. This has been just so much fun and productive, and I learned so much from hearing all three of you. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dexter.
Thanks for organizing, Dexter.
Yeah, and I've been speaking with Christopher Dietrich, Emily Conroy Krutz, and Megan Black about A Companion to U.S. Foreign Relations, Colonial Era to the Present. And you've been listening to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network.